Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with actor Sarah Marcy, who is here in Sarasota, Florida, co-starring in a production of collected stories for the Banyan Theater. Sarah's story is atypical for actors. Sarah had to fight her upbringing, her childhood, everything that her early life taught her in order to honor who she really is. And the story of how she did that is truly inspiring. So hang on. Here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap.
The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. Not the person that your childhood told you should be. Not the person your parents wanted you to be, encouraged you to be, told you to be. Not the person that other people are. Not the person that you saw other people being. A lot of this is how we arrive at what we demonstrate, what we show the world. But unfortunately, quite often, all those things, what our childhood said, what our parents wanted, who our parents were, who our siblings were, what our school wanted, they aren't who we are. This is a real dilemma for a lot of people. As a therapist, I see this in my office all the time. People struggling with sadness, distress, pain, depression, unhappiness, and not understanding that so much of those unpleasant experiences, those feelings, are simply the result of the fact that they are not being who they really are, that they're at odds with themselves, that they're in denial for something significant about themselves, that they are pretending, even to themselves. putting on an act. In my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, I call this a cover story. Like spies have cover stories, that is, they are pretending to be something because if what they really were was known, it would be dangerous. Well, that's what I think happens to most of us, that we decide quite early in life, based on all those other inputs that I was talking about earlier, that being something would be dangerous, would cost us affection, attention, care, might bring us criticism, neglect, punishment, abuse, teasing, all kinds of bad stuff. So we design a cover story based on those things which we think are going to go down okay, that are going to bring us what we desire, which is to be cared for and cared about. Unfortunately, later in life, we need all of who we are, and we feel the loss even when we're not sure why we're feeling so bad. So The Lynn Show is about making this point, saying maybe you had to leave something behind, something about the way you are or looked, something about the way you think, something about a skill that you were drawn to or attracted to or seemed to have. And if that is so, then it is really of value to you to try and recover it. It's not a simple case of, oh yes, I used to have this really outrageous sense of humor, and now that you mention it, I think I'll just go back and get it. It's not really like that. It can be more complicated and more difficult. But it is possible, and that is, of course, one of the things that psychotherapy is designed to do. So if you think that you have left some of you behind and wish to try and recover it, you might want to think about exploring psychotherapy. And if you want to talk to me about that, then you can go up on my website, thelynshow.com. That's thelynnesHOW. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. Thelynshow.com. Click on Email Me and ask me whatever question you have, or if you'd like to talk to me, tell me that. Or if you'd like me to come and talk to your group or organization, ask me about that as well. Up on the website, you can not only talk to me, get a copy of the book, and listen to all of the past shows, including this show, and hear all of the interviews, including the one I'm about to do. And as I said in the run-up, this interview is with Sarah Morsi, whose early life had nothing to do with who she is. And in her attempt to be the good child, the good daughter, the good human being, she tried very hard to be what her early life said she should be, even though her need, her desire, her passion to be an actor, to do the work of acting, was clear from the beginning. And the story of how she achieved that is really remarkable. And so I'm not going to say another word. I'm going to let Sarah tell you her story. So here now is Sarah Morsi.
Okay, I'm here with Sarah Morsi, who is co-starring in the Banyan production of Collected Stories.
Correct.
Good. This way, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Right.
And it's quite clear that mm-hmm. you are making your living, part of your life, part of your life, living, all of your life.
All of that.
Right.
Yes.
With the art of acting?
Yes.
Yes. You would define yourself as an actor?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. So I only ask one question. Do you remember the very first moment in your life when it occurred to you that being looked at, having an impact, telling a story, getting applause, any of that appealed to you, drew you, occurred to you?
It's funny because I hear people talk about that all the time. It wasn't exactly like that for me. I remember the first moment, I think, or I remember several of the first moments. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. There's a lot of art there. There was, even when I was a kid. And one of the things that we did was go to the Louisville Children's Theater. And it was in a really old building called the Belknap Playhouse, which was on the campus of the University of Louisville. And it was one of those really tiny theaters, but very ornate, you know, but very old-timey, everything made out of wood, and lots of old pictures of actors on the walls, like really, really old pictures, you know, from another century. And it was just a very ornate old theater. And I remember feeling like in there that, you know, I was in church. This was the place, you know. This was the real church. I don't know what anything else was, but this was the real place.
About how old were you?
I guess I was little, like 6 or 7 probably then.
It's interesting to me because it's clear when you talk about it, the impact that it had on you. I mean, at 6 or 7, you remember all these details, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, of course, I had more experiences in that theater over the years, so I guess maybe some of that is
still there,
twice remembered or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so you're 6 or 7, and they take you to this place, and the place itself has a, you can feel the ambiance in the place itself, right? And it speaks to you. Do you remember anything you saw there? Or?
Yes, I saw Reynard the Fox. That was the production. and it was wonderful. I don't remember that much about it, but I remember it was just astonishing. And then we were allowed to go backstage and meet the actors. And this is where I think I differ from most people. I was scared to death. I didn't want to meet them.
Yeah.
I didn't want to see those grown-up people and all that makeup with masks and all of that. Very scary to me.
Yes.
And I did go back, but I stayed way back and just observed.
You were drawn to the fantasy, to the play.
Yeah.
But not, you didn't want to know about what was behind it.
Not to the players.
No, yeah, yeah. I think that is very interesting.
Well, I thought they were sort of like maybe certain gods or something. You know?
Yes.
I really felt like this was something that special people got to do.
Yeah.
Not me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Not me.
Yeah, this was magic, too, for you, right?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Right. Okay, yeah. So here you are, captured by the thing, and thinking, not me. So what happens after that?
Well, another time I remember, it's not that good what happens after that. Another time I remember, then I started taking dancing lessons, you know, ballet lessons.
Did you want them?
Oh, yeah, I think I did. But I don't know if I wanted them as much as my mom wanted them for me. See, my mom, you know, my parents grew up during the Depression, couldn't do the things she wanted to do, and then, of course, her kids were going to do all the things she wanted to do.
Right.
So I don't know that I wanted them that bad, but then as soon as I began to take them, then that was another magic sort of place. You know, that it was, I was really shy as a kid. And I can remember sitting outside before going into the class and being so shy, and the other kids would be playing and running around kind of, you know, nuts wild and having a great time. And I just wanted to get in there where everybody was quiet. You just watched the teacher and did what she did. That's what I loved. You
and
know?
It was safe, too.
It
to
was safe. That was a safe place. Because then I was doing the right thing, and, you know, I could...
Good girl.
Yeah, I was a good girl, for sure. So.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And I remember my first dance recital. I remember being on stage.
How old were you?
I was 6.
Still 6? My God.
Yeah,
okay, good.
I was 6. And I remember being on stage. I remember the feel of that, and I don't remember it as something... I loved doing the dancing, you know, and I loved being in the costume and all of that. But as far as the applause and the feeling of, you know, that's what I love, I never had that.
No.
Ever.
No, for you it was the thing itself.
It was the thing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely the thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you've discovered now this... a couple of magical places and something that you love to do. So I'm assuming you keep taking dance.
I keep taking dance. I keep taking every class I can take. My parents send me to here, to there,
this
wherever I want to go. No, it's not all dance. Some of it is acting classes. You know, mostly dance. I love the dance the most.
Did you like the acting classes? Do you remember?
I do remember. I was terribly shy.
Yes.
And I remember they were taught, a lot of them were taught by youngish, you know, kids who were in college. And they were always drawn to the kids who were more outgoing,
yeah.
more, you know,
yeah.
the right. show-off kids.
Right.
And
well, they made the show-off kids made it easier for them.
I guess maybe that's true, you know. Yeah, I guess that's true. And I always found that very hard, you know. And I've always felt like improv is hard.
Yes.
You know, not as hard now. But when I was younger, I always thought improv was so hard. Much easier to be given a script or something to do.
It's the same thing as watching the teacher and do what she says.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And there's real safety in that.
Absolutely.
I can't make a big mistake here. I can't be... If I am able to do what's expected, mm-hmm. I'll be fine.
Right. But I'll not only be fine, I will be transported.
Oh, my.
See, that's the thing. That's the place, you know, that not only will I be fine, but this will be, you know.
Magic.
Yeah, it is. It's magic.
I know. Did you feel that ever for the acting or just...
Yeah.
You
yeah.
did. So when you got that right... Mm-hmm. Or when you felt that you got it right, you could inhabit the character and it was transporting.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So what a dilemma for you. You know, I mean, because, you know, you've said several times this is not typically what actors say.
It's not what I've heard people say.
No, and I think you're right. No, I think you're right. I think for so many actors, they love the thing, mm-hmm. but they also love the attention, the applause, the being out there, the, you know, whatever,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And your shyness really played against that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so that's a real struggle for a young girl, I think. So, okay, so you've got all these glasses, and you have the dilemma of feeling not... chosen particularly by the teachers, but loving the thing. It's
absolutely,
really, yeah. really a tug-of-war for you.
Yeah.
So in elementary school, in junior high school, in high school, were you in any plays? Did you join a drama class? Did you...
You know, I did, but it was kind of, you know, every year you would do a class play. There wasn't any sort of, like, track to go on to be.
So they didn't have a drama class or you didn't, right, okay.
Yeah, not really.
Right.
Yeah.
So were you in some of those school plays?
Yeah, I was when I was in high school. Well, I went to Catholic school, so I went to, when I got in high school, I went to school with all girls. Mm. So the only way to be in a play with anything but all girls, and I was in some of the plays with all girls. I always played boys because I was tall. I think my first big role was Algernon and The Importance of Being Earnest. But I went over to the boys' high schools. There were other, you know, there were boys' high schools who had auditions for plays. Mm-hmm. And mostly, well, not all, but mostly musicals, you know. So I went to those. And
you auditioned?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I did. Yeah.
How, I'm imagining that it was... I don't know, a challenge.
It was a challenge. You know, the worst part of it was that I can't sing worth a flip. And so the dance audition was always easy to me because mm-hmm. I had taken dance, you know, and they were fairly basic steps and stuff. So the dance audition was always great. But then I would come to the singing audition and it would be, oh, God, that I really had no voice. You know, literally, I couldn't get any voice to come out practically. So... And then, you know, I'd do the reading audition. And finally, what would happen, it would be like they'd send me back in to the singing guy. See, can't just get it, you know. And then finally, I'd get a role, you know, like in the chorus or something to, you know, to be in the play.
Yeah, because they wanted your other skills.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. The other skills were good, but the singing was not so
well,
good.
Well, but were you aware of that? I mean, how did you feel about it? Did you feel... bad because you
yeah, right.
So again, this is just interesting to me. This is something that we human beings seem to do,
mm-hmm.
And that is here they wanted you the dancer and they wanted the actor, mm-hmm. but what you focused on was they didn't want the singer.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Right. Yeah. It's a shame that we do that. I think.
Yeah, but, I guess that's true. You know. I guess you do.
Okay. So all right. So now, at any point in this. You know, period of time, are you thinking this might be a career, this is something I want to do?
You know, one time when I was, I think I might have been in the high school age, I said to my mom, that would be the most wonderful thing, to be able to to do that, to be a dancer or be an actor and get to do what you love and get paid for that.
Wow.
You know.
Mm-hmm. What did she say? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. I remember. I can see. Yes, clearly. Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, that would be nice, but you can't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's almost impossible to do that. You know, you have to think about getting a job that you can make a living, and, you know, you want to have a family and be a normal person, and you don't want to do that. You know, but mostly it was, you don't want to do that.
Yeah, but what's so funny to me about this is here is this mother who instigates,
yes.
She puts you in all these classes, right?
Absolutely.
And then she doesn't want you to,
Not for life, not for life, just for fun.
No,
that's for fun.
I understand, but she didn't get it.
No, not at all.
No,
she didn't get it.
Okay, so you say that to her in high school, and she tells you that you don't want that, which is what parents...
My dad was mainly the one that would say, you don't want to do that. My mom wouldn't flat out say, you don't want to do it, but she would sort of say, well, you really can't, you know.
What are you thinking?
Yeah, what are you thinking?
Right, you can't do that.
Crazy stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So... at some point, you must have made this choice. What happened?
Oh, gosh. Well, it was longer than just bang right away. What happened was I started the college, and I was really naive and immature. And my parents said to me, we're not going to pay for you to, major in theater or something. There weren't even dance programs then. I didn't even know of any dance programs like there are now. And we're not going to pay for a major in theater. You already know all about that. You don't need to get a college degree in that. You need to get a degree in something where you can get a job. So I did. I got a Bachelor of Science degree, and I became a dental hygienist. I went to dental hygiene school my last 2 years of college.
Oh.
And that's painful because I almost lost my mind, I think. I really, at first I thought, well, I just can do this. This will be a different thing,
Yeah.
And I'll love this. Well, then it became pretty clear that wasn't going to be the thing I loved, And what happened was I started teaching at a dancing school, so that was my outlet. And
while you're practicing as a dental hygienist?
Yeah. And before I ever even got out of school, I almost lost it. I almost had like a complete mental breakdown. I quit going to plays. I quit going to theater.
It was too painful.
Yeah, I wouldn't go see anything. My mom would say, oh, there's this great show and we'll get you a ticket if you want to go see it.
So what's happening is nobody understands.
Oh, no, nobody.
No, including you. That what's happening here is
probably
that,
not me, yeah.
No, certainly not you.
Mm-hmm.
That you're trying to be that good girl.
Mm-hmm.
They're telling me what to do. I need to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, damn. It's the opposite of who I am.
Exactly.
But never mind. All my training is I'm a good girl and I do what they tell me.
Right.
And so it must be all right. And anyway, this was always a safe place to do what they tell me. What a disconnect must have been going on inside of you.
Yeah, and it was, I guess. Yeah.
Nobody could have seen it. Because...
yeah.
Because you couldn't have seen it. So
right.
So how did you manage to arrive back at yourself? You understand what I'm asking?
Yeah. It's a pretty specific point in time. Well, I kept teaching at the dance studio, and so that was a huge outlet for me. I didn't only teach. I made the scenery, and I, helped on the costumes, and I swept the floor, and I was there every free moment. What happened was, though, I went and auditioned for a play at the community theater. And it was a play I had seen at Actors Theater of Louisville, because that's a, that's a great regional theater. And I did at some point start going back to the theater. And, every time I went, it broke my heart. But I still felt like these people are so lucky that they got to do it. I just don't get to,
Who do you think you are?
Yeah, I knew I could.
Yes.
No question that I could.
You didn't think you could.
No, I wasn't like the chosen one.
Right,
Right. And the people who did had a very, here's the thing, they had a very different disposition than I did.
They were more like those kids in the acting class.
They were kids who could pick up and say, I'm moving to New York.
Ah, yes.
And I'm going to, get a job, whether it's in a regional theater or whether it's going to be there. You know, I'm going to go and start auditioning, and that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. Weren't kids who were waiting for the person to tell them what to do so they could do it.
Absolutely not. No. Right. They were not that kind of kids. And I knew those kind of kids as a dancer, too, who, you know, I'm going to, you know, as soon as I get out of high school or whatever, I'm going to go to New York, and I'm going to do that.
Right.
You know.
So you saw it.
I saw it.
But you couldn't
do it. I saw how
it
was. Yeah. But then I sort of convinced myself, you know, well, that's no way to live, you know.
Well, you had your whole history was telling
right.
you that.
I mean. Right.
Right. And you were still trying to be good.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so what made you go audition for this play?
I was working with people who were, you know, talking about there was this play going on, and I knew the play. I auditioned for that, and I got in that play. Here's a really clear memory. All the shift changes in that play took place on stage because it's set up with these three vanities, the girls'
yes.
vanities. So they're getting ready on stage for, you know, each of the scene yeah. shifts, and then the vanities go off, and they're in the next scene. And one night, during one of those shifts, the director of the show comes back behind me and looks over my shoulder into the mirror and says, "Are you sure you want to be a dental hygienist?"
Oh, my. I see. Deus ex machina, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Then I made a lot of friends who were also in that place of... Now we were out of college. We were still young, and we were still thinking about, well, now what are we going to do? And a lot of my friends had degrees in theater. I was in a different group of people. The University of Louisville had started this Master of Fine Arts program in acting, and I read about it in the Sunday paper. And when I read that, I was like, that is the program I need to be in. But then selling them on the fact that you're a dental hygienist and you want to be in this acting program and you don't have an undergraduate degree in acting. That was the deal. So I went and I told them what I wanted, and they thought I was crazy too, because they were like, "Well, you're making a good living and you can do the community theater and do all of that. You got it knocked, you know."
Right.
Yeah, what do you want to do this for? And of course that's all that I just really wanted to do that. I wanted to study acting, and I wanted to study, you know, it's a three-year program. It's a Master of Fine Arts. It sounds like it's just a master degree, you know, 30 hours master degree. Not, it's a three-year program. So they were kind of loath to have me in. What happened was I auditioned and did a few shows. I got cast in a few shows, and then they sort of said, okay, all right, we'll have you.
Wow.
Yeah, so I kind of got in the back door there.
Well, what's interesting to me about this is that after a lifetime of I'm too shy and I'm not going to put myself forward and I'm mm-hmm. not going to make, you know, you found somehow,
mm-hmm.
you know, the courage, the, you know,
yeah.
to say I want it, you know, give
right.
it to me, give it to me.
Right.
Amazing.
I had a new set of friends who were much more supportive than that. You got to do it. You got to, you know.
Yeah, right.
You got to do this. You got to
do it. It's okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's not who do you think you are. This is who you are.
Right, yeah. No question, everybody already knew it then, because we were different people than the ones I had been hanging with in another
life
profession, who were also wonderful people, but not, you know.
No, they...
Not
they
understanding. Although there were those few people it took to get me into the right crowd. And, you know, that was interesting. The people who were really like, you got to go do that. You know.
It's lovely.
You got to go do that.
It's lovely that you had that.
It is, yeah.
And it's lovely that you had that, but that doesn't take away in any sense that you went for it. And it really goes against everything in your earlier life.
Yeah,
so it must have taken tremendous courage, I think.
I guess, I don't think of it like that, but yeah, I guess it did. It was, I don't know if it was courage or just pure need.
That's the word that was going through my mind.
The need, I had to do it.
Yeah, I believe you. I believe you.
I have this quote by Carl Willenda, you know, the eldest mm-hmm. Willenda, who died falling off the high wire in his 70s. Living is walking the wire. Everything else is waiting.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
I think there's, like, some truth to that.
I
you know?
Do. Well, I think that most people can't do that, so they wouldn't agree.
Well, yes, it sounds ridiculous.
No, I don't think it's... Oh, no, I absolutely don't think it sounds ridiculous. I think it sounds right.
Right.
But I think that most people are raised pretty much the way you were raised.
Right.
And so it's they can't do it.
Right.
So they couldn't see it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But for people who not only can do it, but people who can't do other, you couldn't do other. For whatever reason,
yeah,
you couldn't do it. Your whole early life mitigates against this.
Yeah, it really did.
It
I
does,
really,
yeah.
All the things I loved the most were the things that were... And at that time, it was sort of a... now it's different, you know, with these college prep schools and stuff. I went to a real college prep school. And if you had any intelligence whatsoever, they would really not let you take the art classes, the home ec classes, the secretarial type, you know, learn to type. They would not let you take that. That was not part of what your training was.
Right. Okay. So coming out of that environment, coming out of what I'm assuming is a fairly religious Catholic upbringing,
mm-hmm.
Again, very patriarchal, very... You do the right things,
mm-hmm.
being basically shy, being a good girl, all that stuff.
Yeah.
It just says to me that this was yours.
Yeah, this was mine.
This was yours, and it didn't matter, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Right. When you decided to take the MA in fine arts, did you tell your parents? Did they know? Did they care? Did they?
Yeah, they cared.
I'm sure.
They knew. They cared.
All right.
My sister still... This still brings this up because I told her, she didn't hear it, but my mom and I had lots of arguments about it. But one was a screaming, huge argument in which my mom, I guess, finally pulled out the big guns and said, you can't become an actor. You own an apartment full of furniture. I think that was her final, you know. What are you going to do with all your furniture? Yeah, that was in a really screaming, heated, you know, moment that only later did that seem absolutely hilarious to me. And my sister will still bring that up to me. Well, how can you do that? You have
right.
a house full of furniture.
Right. Well, you know, what you're saying is that this is so out of her sense of what the world is about, what's
right.
good, what's right. All right, so you get into this program,
mm-hmm.
And you, I'm assuming you take it, and
yeah.
and I'm also assuming that you love it.
I loved it. I loved every minute of it. I was a little bit older than, you know, some of the students. Not all, though, because they had started taking a few, thank goodness, before me, they had taken a few people who didn't have necessarily majors in theater. You know, they had a major in history or English or something.
Right, right.
And
they also had been good.
Yeah, they also
right,
had gotten,
right.
yeah,
right.
On the wrong path there somehow. So, and they had a few, you know, older, I guess, students. I wasn't that much older. I was about 4 years older. But, you know, when you're young like that, 4 years is a lot.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you're 30 and everybody else is 26.
Oh, yeah.
That's, you know, that's a big difference. Yeah.
Okay, so you're older,
mm-hmm.
but does that have an impact on your experience there?
You know, the thing about it is going to school there in Louisville and having Actors Theater there, which is a wonderful regional theater. The school wasn't really tied up with actors, you know, tightly, but we had some classes from people who were over there. And it just gave me the idea that I really wanted to work in regional theater. I didn't really particularly care about going to New York and
mm-hmm.
being on Broadway or anything. And because, I mean, I really loved dramas. I did a lot of comedies too, but by this time I wasn't singing and dancing anymore, you know. And I wanted to work in regional theater. What never occurred to me was that all regional theater was not as good as what I saw at Actors Theater of Louisville. That
yeah.
that was the sort of eye-opener that I got after that. But it worked out like that. I just started, you know, I started getting jobs in the summertime when I was in school, and then, you know, I just started getting jobs. I don't, you know, by people I knew and by going to auditions and...
You started to work.
Yeah,
right.
I started to work.
And did this surprise you?
No.
No, you expected it.
I expected, yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And did your family ever come around?
Oh, yeah, they came. They came to see everything I did. When I was in Louisville, they did. And especially when I was in grad school. Now, my parents did have this, I guess they had at least one experience of coming to see something and realizing it wasn't always going to be a light comedy, or, you know, maybe the language was not going to be exactly right, or the story was going to be really dark or whatever. And I'm not sure what... Oh, I know what happened. I was doing a Carol Churchill play, and the language in Carol Churchill plays is really tough. And this was, it was a great play called Vinegar Tom. It was about the witch hunts, not in the States, but in the 17th century in England. And it was really a story about all these strong women. And one of the side stories was about the, you know, all different things happened to these women. They were from all different walks of life. And so one of the side stories was the fact that these women who were sort of healers or shamans or whatever, they would be called out as witches, you know, because mm-hmm. they didn't want the strong women. They wanted to get rid of them. So there was really bad language in this play and stuff. And my parents came to see this play, and then they were going to come back with a lot of friends of theirs. And my mom called their friends and said, "You don't want to see that play." So, I think that was, you know, I did have that experience. Now, other things, you know I came down, my first play in Florida that I came down to do, I had worked with a director in Indiana, and she got a job down at in St. Pete at American Stage directing. So she brought me down there to do this play called Mrs. Klein, and it was a big, heavy-duty drama about Melanie Klein, who's a real person, who was a contemporary of Sigmund Freud. And I played her daughter, and it's just three women. It's Melanie Klein and her daughter, and then her daughter's best friend, who is really sort of Melanie Klein's mother's favorite. And so the daughter's kind of on the outside. And I came down to play that play in Florida. Who would have thought that play was going to be? It was really an out there play. It was actually the first theater in. It was a British play, and it was the first theater in America that presented it.
Wow, when was this?
It was in the late 80s in St. Pete at American Stage. And I was like, oh, yeah. I had read this play in American Theater Magazine. You know, you could order plays and stuff in the back. And I ordered this one because it was three women, and I thought, oh, you know, that'll be so esoteric and so much, you know, about... psychoanalysis,
yeah,
and
right.
This woman psychoanalysis in, you know, in, I guess she was in Germany at this time. So besides having the Holocaust, you know, and Freud, and she also had to get out of Germany, then all this other stuff going on. It was very heavy-duty drama. It was a really wonderful play, but some of my relatives from Kentucky were in Florida for vacation, you know, at the time. So they were like, well, we're going to come over and see your play, you know. And they did, and I don't know what they must have thought of that. They were probably just taken aback, because I'm sure they thought the play would be like, you know, like a play like...
Neil Simon.
Yeah, these were not people, you know, who had seen a lot of plays, these particular ones who were coming. So mm-hmm. I think they probably, I don't know what they must have gone back and said about what I was doing. I can't even imagine what their reaction to that must have been.
But again, it's almost as though, like, this is the image I have. You're a unicorn who grew up amongst cows.
Oh, God, that's sort of...
That's what it sounds like.
It's not very complimentary of the cows.
Well, okay, then you're a unicorn who grew up around ponies.
Right,
It's not that there's something wrong with them. It's just that you don't fit.
I know. It's like, well, you know, in the Glass Menagerie, Laura's little menagerie,
right.
You know, she's got the
unicorn.
And after his horn gets broken off, Laura says, it's okay. It's okay, because now he's just like all the other horses. And I'll sit him here on this shelf, and he can play with all the other horses.
Yeah.
You know?
I got tears in my eyes.
I know, but that's what she says.
I know.
And that's very Tennessee Williams to say that. You know?
Yeah. So, but you never got your horn broken.
No, thank goodness.
Yeah, right. Because you found other unicorns.
Absolutely.
So you didn't have to go on pretending that you were actually a horse.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, nice.
Good. Yeah. Great, actually.
Yeah.
Okay, so you start auditioning and you start getting jobs all around the country in regional theater?
Yeah, mostly around where I could get to. So what happened was I moved to Chicago. I didn't want to move to New York. New York was so overwhelming to me. I had been to New York quite a lot. I had a cousin who lived up in New York, and, I would go to visit. But I really, it was overwhelming to me. I didn't like it in New York. And so I moved to Chicago, and I thought, well, Chicago's a big city. They have a lot of theater, and I'll audition there and get, hired by some regional theater, and I'll go off wherever.
Right.
And that was my idea, to do that. And finally, that sort of in a roundabout way led to me coming down to Florida, which is the last state in the union, I think, maybe except Alaska, that I would have thought, that I wanted to go to. In fact, that job I got, I was talking to somebody about this the other day. There used to be, because nothing was online or anything, there was this theater directory that was published by somebody in Vermont, and it was a big, 8.5 by 11 book, and it was all sort of looked like it had been typed out, but not, it was printed, and it had all the regional theaters in the country in there. And so I looked this one up, American Stage in St. Pete, and here's what it said: an anomaly in the land of dinner theater.
Oh, God.
This, we present blah de blah, and Tennessee Williams and classics and new plays and all of this.
They still do.
They still do. Yeah. So I was like, oh, wow, that sounds like heaven. Mm-hmm. So I went down there. I fell in love with that theater. Mm-hmm. I did. I stayed there for about 4 seasons. And then the people who were running the theater then moved on. And I, in the meantime, had gone to audition at other theaters in Florida, and I was working a lot at the Hippodrome, which is in Gainesville. So I started thinking of that as my artistic home, sort of. This is all sort of whacked because nobody really has a company anymore. I just missed out on the period when people really had a company.
Right.
In the late 80s, everything that you read about and talked about as an actor or a director or anybody in the theater who did jobs in the theater was finding an artistic home. That was sort of what you talked about, And then I kind of did do that, but it's not exactly like you have a job all the time, because the people I knew who were in the acting company in Louisville, they were hired for the whole season, even if they weren't doing every play. I don't know, what they would do otherwise exactly, but they hired them and picked plays for them. Mm-hmm. They might have a tiny role in one and a bigger role.
That's what we had here.
Yeah, exactly. And that was my dream. It's still, it's still a dream to me. I think that is the best way to do theater because you know how each other works.
Oh, yeah, there's
and
no question about it.
Yeah, and you can put things up and you can share in ways that, it's still in Europe, that's.
You're not reinventing it every time.
Right, every time.
Yeah. Right, I know.
Yeah.
Okay, so the 80s, we're here now in 2015, so what happened between the late 80s and now?
I stayed forever in Gainesville, and I...
Do you live there?
I live in Gainesville.
Oh, I didn't know.
I do. Mm-hmm. I stayed there, and I... one thing I did for a long time was I taught classes at the community college. They only had, for adjuncts to teach, 2 classes, which were intro to theater and then intro to acting. So I taught those 2 classes every semester for a long time, and then I would augment that salary with my salary from the Hippodrome, where I would do 3 or 4 shows a season.
Mm-hmm.
It was good. It was nice. Okay, and it was a wonderful kinds of shows, that were very challenging and, some fluffy stuff, but mostly really wonderful stuff that we were doing. And then at one point during that whole thing, one of the directors said she didn't want anybody to have another job. She wanted to be able to call, everybody in the show at whatever time she wanted for some reason. And so I quit teaching at the community college. I didn't really love it anyway, but it was okay. I liked it. So I quit teaching at the community college. And then once in a while I would get a class at UF if somebody went on sabbatical or something like that. You know, they'd call me and I'd do a class for a semester. And that was okay, but then what happened was I was like, well, I got to start getting back out. You know, if I, as I got older, there weren't four shows a season less and less. So I started going back out and getting, you know, getting some shows in other parts of Florida to augment my my existence now.
To pay for your furniture.
Yeah, to pay for my house full of furniture. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So that's the story. And
that's how you wound up here?
Yeah, I did. That's how I wound up here. I came to an audition at the Banyan. I saw it, you know, going on. It had been around a while, and some of the first people who worked at the Banyan were some of the people I knew who had worked at Actors Theater of Louisville. Mm. So I was like, oh, well, they must be pretty good. Mm-hmm. And so it was a long time before I came over and auditioned, but then I did. I think I might have auditioned one time and not gotten cast, but then I came over and auditioned for the season when A Lesson from Aloes was on the mm-hmm. On the season. And I didn't think I was auditioning for that. I was too old to do it, I thought, you know, because I think those people are in their 40s, and this was just a couple of years ago. But Peter Thomason had already been cast, and they love him very much, and they started talking to me about the woman's role in that, and I was like, well, I think I'm too old, don't you? And they were like, no, with the guy we've got, you're, you know. So it ended up that they cast me in that, and I did that, so, yeah.
So then you're on their radar.
Yeah, then I'm on their radar. Then, you know, this time, actually I was doing this show, Collected Stories, at Florida Repertory Theater, which is in Fort Myers. They have a little small space. And I was doing Collected Stories in the fall, this past fall, and Jerry Finn and his wife Terry came over to see it. And that very night he saw it. He was like, I want to do this play. So
wow.
keep your summer open. I want you to do it.
Wow.
Yeah.
I lied at the beginning. I actually asked two questions.
Oh, okay.
And the other question, well, actually, before I ask the other question, you want to say something about the play?
The play mm-hmm. is fabulous.
Yeah.
It is. It's sort of an All About Eve story, but that's giving it short shrift. It's about two women writers, the older woman who has sort of made a name for herself, and she's teaching at Columbia, I think it's named, and she has picked up little sort of proteges along the way, but this young woman who comes into her apartment one day, she has students over to do tutorials in her apartment because she says she's a terrible slug. If one of us has to schlep, it may as well be you. You're younger, you know. Mm-hmm. So she has this young woman come over, and the woman is terribly talented, and she just, of course, falls for her. And it's there, the play takes place over sort of, I think, a 5 or 6 year period in which the young writer starts getting her sea legs and the older writer is going downhill a bit. I don't want to give too much away, it's what happens between the two of them, and, you know, what happens when the student becomes the teacher, sort of, and
or old enough to challenge.
Yeah, yeah. It's a wonderful, wonderful, beautifully written play by Donald Margulies, who wrote Time Stands Still. Mm-hmm. That's sort of his, I don't think he's written anything since that. That was just new in the last couple of years, and it won a lot of awards. And this is one of his good plays, I think. I did another play by him, Dinner with Friends, years ago. And you know that one?
I do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That one, I don't think, that one really resonated with people, I think, you know. But this one, I don't know, I think this was is a better one.
This one gets done a lot.
I guess it does.
I have seen that it is being done mm-hmm. other places.
Well, I think now, too, ever since, you know, the big 2007, 2008 slump and everything.
Two character plays, one set?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yay! Well, let's do that. Right.
Yeah.
And it's a good play? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Right.
That's
the jackpot. Right, yeah. Right. Okay, so this is my other question. having given a life, and you have given a life to work.
Yeah.
So would you say something about what that is like?
Well, it's the only way to go, if it's the only way to go.
Oh,
I have no regrets whatsoever. I also have not much savings whatsoever. You know, working enough to keep going is the greatest thing. And then at some point it's like, ooh, wow, maybe just working enough to keep going is not
enough.
Enough.
Yeah.
Right. So there are those challenges, but I would not do anything different. I think I don't know, I think I saved my life. I think I saved my own life. I had to do it. I had to do it. I don't know if I had to do it over again, if I would be more ambitious about where I did it. I don't know if I would, because I don't regret that. You know, when somebody is seeing a play, an audience in Sarasota, Florida, or Gainesville, Florida, or Louisville, Kentucky, is touched just the same as an audience in New York City. You know, they're not different people somehow seeing that play. And the people who see the play see the play. And anyway, in our country, they tell me only about 10% of the population really takes in the theater. So, you know, it's not like you're looking for the perfect audience. The audience is the perfect audience. You know.
Yeah, this is spoken by a person for whom it is the work.
Definitely, it is the work.
Yes.
Definitely. It is the work. Well, it is. I mean, I definitely honor the audience.
Oh, and
the
no, work I didn't mean to suggest that you don't honor the audience at all.
Right.
I didn't mean that.
Mm-hmm.
But you're doing the work. It doesn't matter where you do it.
No, it doesn't matter at all.
That's what I meant.
Yeah.
That's what I heard.
Yeah. It's the work. It's definitely the work. The work is so wonderful. The rehearsal is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I could just rehearse all the time, I would be fine. I'd be fine without having to even ever, you know. I don't know how that would be. You know, that would be some kind of probably weird purgatory or hell or something, just always rehearsing, never going on stage. Maybe not, though. I love rehearsal.
I know. Mm-hmm. No, I think if they paid you for it, you might
as well. You may as well do it.
Yeah. This is wonderful and a very good place to stop.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
I enjoyed it.
Me too.
I think I saved my own life. One can hardly say anything more dramatic than that. And it is my belief, and of course the point of the Lynn Show, that being who you really are, integrating into your life all of those things which your early life may have forced you to deny, to hide, to put aside, that is saving your life. It is the life that the person that you are is meant to live. All of the things that come with the territory of being you. That is your life. So I could not possibly have said it better than Sarah. And she makes the point, as so many of the people I interview, people who make their living or their life with an art makes, and that is that the idea of being financially solvent, having a lot of furniture, that's nice and it's important and no one would dismiss that, but it is not the most important. The most important is honoring oneself, being who you really are. And of course, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art because when you listen to people like Sarah, you hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. We are not a culture that honors or makes living a life of art an easy thing to do. And Sarah's early life is not in any way atypical of so many people who had to buck the conventional wisdom that giving your life to an art as an actor or a dancer or a playwright or a singer or an architect even, is a foolish thing to do. That is what the conventional wisdom says. Lots of the people that I interview were lucky enough to have parents who may have had that point of view but did not lay that on their children, that they saw very early the need, the desire, the passion, the naturalness, and so encouraged it. And then there are people like Sarah who figured out a way to save their own life. Unfortunately, I think the larger number of we humans on the planet are people who don't find a way to save our life in that way. And so the Lynn Show is about saying, when you hear Sarah, you hear what it sounds like. If there's something that you denied, something that you had to put aside, some part of yourself which you don't have access to, it may not be too late to get it back, to save your life. So, again, if you want to talk about that, come to my website, thelinshow.com. And as always, I hope that you got something that you can use from this show. Inspiration, of course, that's always my hope. But maybe it's just listening to me and Sarah. I had such a good time in this interview, as you can hear. Maybe it's just that you discovered that Collected Stories is playing and you're going to come out and hear it. Well, whatever it is, I hope it is something that brings you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Fiend